significance of this?
Well, I think that he is not planning to visit there. I think because, you know, his administration is worried that he's going to make some provocative statements that could really trigger the North Koreans. And so right now, I think what is really important is that there is grassroots mobilization across the country in the United States, massive protests being planned for November 11th for Armistice Day by Veterans for Peace.
We're going to have to leave it there, Christine, but we'll do part two and post online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. For joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming up on 8 o'clock, and up next is More Talk Radio. You can call in at 503-231-8187 with your questions. And now these messages.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema in Portland. Muertos PDX will be hosting its annual Dia de los Muertos celebration with musical performances, a children's story time, calavera decorating stations, mariachi, Katrina's traditional Mexican cuisine, and much more. A portion of this year's proceeds will benefit Oregon por Mexico for earthquake relief in Mexico. Again, that's Muertos PDX 9th annual Dia de los Muertos celebration on Sunday, November 2nd at noon at Adios Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Romeo is Bleeding is a documentary that follows Dante Clark, a young poet transcending the violence in his hometown of Richmond, California, by writing about his experiences. Dante and the like-minded youth of the city mount an urban adaptation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, with the hope of starting a dialogue about violence in the city. PDX Poetic Justice's John Slaughter and his group of poets will be reading some of their works before the screening. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Today is Monday, October 30th, 2017, and you are listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott. And if you're listening, then you know you're listening on 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, Albany, and via the World Wide Web. It is kboo.fm. This morning, we are so excited. Well, I'll speak for myself because Celeste isn't here yet, but she is also excited to have with us Nicole Lindahl, a scholar, researcher, and activist. Dr. Lindahl is teaching a course at Portland Underground Graduate School this November, and you've taught this course earlier, or a similar course on this?
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. And I taught this course in June also for the Portland Underground Grad School, but I've kind of modified it a little bit for this next version of it.
Yeah, exciting. And the course is entitled Mass Incarceration and the War on Drugs, subtitle Understanding and Moving Beyond the Current Prison Crisis. And that's a very important topic, it's things people are wrestling with in many different ways. How did you begin become interested in this very important issue?
So I've been interested since I first set foot in a prison, which was almost 20 years ago. It was in 1998. And I was an undergraduate at the time at UC Berkeley. And I had a professor who was volunteering as a teacher at San Quentin in a college program that had just started there that offered a two-year, like, associate of arts degree, like a community college program, basically, mm-hmm. that was run entirely by volunteer teachers.
Yes.
And some of us who were the undergraduates in these professors' different classes went in as volunteers to serve as tutors. So that's how I first had this opportunity to go into a prison and to start kind of working with incarcerated men and be helping them with their writing assignments and their, if this was a communications class, so they were writing speeches and that kind of thing. And so that first time going in was really profound for me.
Yeah, I think probably everyone who the first time entering into a prison, it has an impact. And
yeah,
had you before that experience with the course, did you have, what would your expectations would be like going into?
You know, it's such an interesting question. So I come from a middle class background. I did not have a lot of family members or any family members or kind of friends that had been incarcerated. So it was definitely like a foreign world to me. And on the one hand, I think I was very much socialized into the kind of mainstream perception of prisons and prisoners. And, you know, it felt like really potentially dangerous and scary. And like, who are these, you know, what are these people going to be like? And, you know, all of those images are kind of playing, you know, are definitely there.
Yes.
But on the other hand, I grew up in San Francisco and I was an urban youth and I listened to hip hop and I was politically, you know, engaged in some way. And so I also had this suspicion that all of that was going to be, you know, BS. That like once I went inside, there was going to be a totally different reality. And so part of the interest to me in volunteering to do this was to be like, I bet I'm going to have my mind blown by doing this experience. And I want to see if that really happens or, you know, what the real deal is.
The reality.
Yeah. Yes. And even having had that suspicion in the back of my mind, I was still completely floored by the experience. And just, you know, there's just something that you can't replicate through words that happens when you're face to face with somebody who, you know, another human being that you can relate to, just like I'm relating to you right now.
Yes.
Who is locked up, you know, who's a prisoner, who's a felon, a convict, you know, who maybe has done, you know, more than one decade or two even behind bars and, you know, who might be in there for something really serious, like a murder, you know?
We're speaking with Nicole Lindahl, who will teach a course on mass incarceration and the war on drugs. And we want to invite callers to join us in our conversation, 503-231-8187. And we'll take callers in a few minutes after some more introductory remarks from Nicole. So flash forward two decades later, and you are immersed in this topic. And tell us a little bit about the course, what people might expect when they take the course.
So like I said, I kind of have, you know, I taught it for the first time in June. It was 4 weeks and it was very content heavy. And it was very much like a traditional classroom experience where, you know, the students came in, we introduced ourselves and there was some interaction, but there was so much material to get through. And I just was kind of lecturing most of the time. And so one of, but there was a lot of excitement in the class about the idea of doing a group project afterwards. You know, people really wanted to take action. And actually that group of students is now continuing to meet, and we are planning a group project. So that's happening. And so in devising this next version of the class, what we decided was, first of all, to extend the amount of time. So it's going to be a 6-week rather than a 4-week class. So we have a little more time to like really engage with the material. And also the lectures are going to be delivered via podcast. So I'm actually producing a podcast as we speak here at KBOO. It's going to stream on the KBOO website, and it's going to be like a a 6-part overview, substantive overview of the history and the impact and the current practices of mass incarceration. And the people in the class will listen to the podcast as homework before the class meetings. And in the class meetings, we're going to do a combination of discussing the material and, you know, asking questions, learning from local experts. So I'm going to have some local people who are already working on this issue come in and talk to the class about what they're doing and the scene here in Oregon. And we're going to devise a class project, or a variety of class projects, depending on what people are interested in. And so that's all going to happen within those 6 class meetings. And the content will be something that people are absorbing in between the meetings.
Oh, that's unique approach in terms of going into the class with having heard the lecture, and so people will come there with a base.
Exactly. And I mean, it's such rich material. It's so interesting and disturbing and intense, and you know that you really need time to process it, you know.
Right.
And that was one of the things that I really learned from that first class, is there wasn't quite enough time for people to, you know. And what we ended up doing was hanging out for like half an hour after the 2-hour class every week, and it was like, you know, people have kids, like they can't do that all the time. So trying to cater the class to what the students really want, and you know, and I think it's really a perfect opportunity for people who are grappling with this issue, who know it's important, but don't yet know how to plug in or what to do in order to take action on it.
Exactly, because I think in recent years, more of the public has become aware of mass incarceration and the crisis we have, and knowing a little bit, you know, glimpses of reports or conversations about either, you know, abolition or prison reform, and not quite knowing what to do or how to grapple with it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, early on, you know, as an undergrad, I suppose, you became involved in this issue. So what are your expectations about the class project and what people will get out of the class?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I think the first expectation I have about what people will get out of the class is that they will be much more educated about the complexity of this issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even, you know, you can read the new Jim Crow, you can watch the 13th, you know, and these are excellent sources of information. But they still just scratch the surface. Like, this really is a very complicated issue, and in order to devise projects and interventions that actually get at the root of the issue rather than kind of tinkering at the margins, I think a deeper education is really necessary. So the first thing is that people will really get a substantive introduction to this topic. And I should say at this point, I do have my PhD and I studied prisons as my, you know, for my research project. So like, while I'm not making this an academic class in the sense that there's going to be writing assignments and read, you know, and that type of stuff, like this really is high quality information, from like the most kind of contemporary cutting edge researchers. The other thing is just, You know, the class project part, I'm kind of leaving it flexible depending on who shows up, right? Yes. So, for example, I got an email a week or so ago from a high school student who was asking whether you have to be over 18 to take the class, which was really exciting. And no, you do not have to be over 18 to take the class. And, you know, what I wrote back to her is, we would love to have you in the class. And also, did you know that Oregon is the third highest state in terms of its juvenile incarceration rate? So, you know, that's something that I actually didn't know until fairly recently. And it would be amazing if there were some young people in the class who wanted to think about starting something, you know, doing some kind of a project, or, you know, whether it's an event, or, you know, starting an educational campaign in their school or whatever, to start educating people about that fact. You know, or doing some research on their own about what is it that might be producing that, and what are the policies, the current policies that are in place that might be targeted, that could start to strip away, you know, peel away at Oregon's extremely high juvenile incarceration rate. So that's just an example, right? Yes. Like, so yeah, it could be that the whole class wants to work on one thing, and it's planning an event that's like a film screening and a panel discussion, right? Like, it could be something like that. But it also could be that there are people in there who have a background in, you know, therapy or, you know, in psychology, and they, what really makes the most sense for them would be to get linked to a local organization that works with clients who are in prison or coming out of prison, and to offer their services or to do trainings for their staff, or, you know, like, it's
open to,
it's open.
That's really important so that people will feel that they have personal investment in project they create, because it means something to them.
Yeah.
Before we go to our calls, I think it might be important just to get a baseline. So, about what we mean by certain terms. So,
sure.
Mass incarceration.
Yeah.
And, you know, we hear about, and the war on drugs. Now, we also recently heard about the president and declaring an opioid crisis, which is different. I assume a different way to approach drugs, but maybe later. But what is mass incarceration?
So, okay. So mass incarceration, I think of it as having three defining features. So what it brought, like, primarily refers to is a dramatic increase in the prison population in the U.S. over the past 40 years. So starting in 1973, after at least 50 years of stability, the incarceration rates in this country started to rise, and they started to rise across all 50 state systems and the federal system. So which is kind of a phenomenal, you know, it's an exceptional thing. So they started this sharp and steady rise that continued all the way till about 2014 or 15, when now they've plateaued. They're kind of like in very minor decline. But mass incarceration really refers to that sharp increase in the prison population. And jail population, the incarcerated population, and the population of people under criminal justice supervision in terms of parole and probation. Another thing that people, you know, that I think of as a defining feature of this is the fact that the U.S. incarcerates more people per capita than any other country in the world. So whereas in those 50 years before the 70s, we were on par in our incarceration rate with other developed countries and with many developing countries, we have exceeded all of them in over this period of time, and we now lead the world by a significant margin. So just that in and of itself is enough. It should be enough for people to understand that there's some kind of a problem, right? Mm-hmm, because it's also not like we live in the safest country in the world or the least violent country in the world, right?
Sure.
So, and then the third piece of it that's super important is the fact that incarceration rates are acutely and disproportionately concentrated among communities of color, and specifically among Black Americans. So the incarceration rate among whites is somewhere nationally is like 400 per 100,000. Mm-hmm. For Latinos, it's like 900 per 100,000. For Native Americans, it's around 1,200 per 100,000. For Black Americans, it's 2,400 per 100,000. So it's, you know, the concentration in Black communities and families and neighborhoods is, it dwarfs any other population. And this is where we start to see this kind of legacy of slavery that Michelle Alexander and Brian Stevenson point out, right? That yes. that slavery didn't end, it evolved.
Evolved, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I want you to say the relationship between this increase in incarceration rate with the Nixon
yes.
war on drugs.
The war on drugs, exactly, yeah. So, you know, so Nixon did kind of escalate the contemporary war on drugs in 68 or 72, like, yeah, 72, I think. Mm-hmm. And then, but when we really see the escalation is in the 80s with the Reagan era. Mm-hmm. And specifically these two major federal legislation packages, which are passed in 86 and 88. And so the primary relationship between the war on drugs and mass incarceration is that the escalation of the war on drugs in the 80s propelled mass incarceration. Like it is the kind of, you know, if you're looking at like mechanical causes, not like psychological causes, yes. but like the mechanics, the policies that actually increased the number of people going to prison and also increased the amount of time they were spending in prison. It's sentencing policies that were enacted through this kind of moral panic that happened around drug use and crack, you know. Not, I mean, crack was the one in the 80s that really shot it through the roof, but also marijuana and you know, heroin and all of that from the 70s. So yeah, I mean, the war on drugs era, starting with Nixon, we start to see changes in law enforcement priorities, making drug use and sales the number one law enforcement priority. And, you know, as we know, you find drugs where you look for them. So if you go to a college dorm and you bust down the doors and, you know, lay everybody out on the floor with a gun to their head and search all of their belongings, you're going to find marijuana and you're going to find hallucinogens and you're going to find opioids and you're going to find crack and cocaine. You're going to find all of it. And the same thing would happen if you busted down the door of Wall Street or, you know, the New York Times for that matter, right? Mm-hmm. Any of these energy, right? You know, anywhere in New York, you're going to find a lot of cocaine. So
it depends on where you look for it. And therefore, historically, in the last few decades, the focus has been on certain communities rather than
absolutely mm-hmm. poor communities and communities of color and the Black community specifically.
Right.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Dr. Nicole Lindahl, who will teach a course at PUG's Portland Underground Graduate School this November on mass incarceration and the war on drugs, understanding this crisis and what we can do for it. A caller asks, will a podcast of the class be available for free to those who had not attend?
Yeah, good question. So the podcast will be available on the KBOO website, and it's going to be available to the general public for free.
Well, but you will miss the...
But you're going to not be able to learn about the local, you know, movement that's already happening here, to plug into it, to have an opportunity to discuss and ask questions in the class. So, yeah, it's and the full podcast will be available starting in mid-December. So it's going to kind of go out piece by piece. But yeah, I mean, I care about this issue enough that I think this is a really, you know, I've chosen not to go a traditional academic path and to become a professor because I want to do public education instead. And I think the podcast is a really great forum for getting this information out to people anywhere who want to know a little bit more.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for making it available. Again, let me remind you, our phone numbers are 503-231-8187 to talk with Dr. Lindhall about mass incarceration in general in her class and November in particular. Let's go to James, who's been very patient holding. Good morning.
Morning.
Hey, James.
Hey, I just wanted to thank you, Nicole, for knowing about what's going on, because I just wanted to share it real quick, my personal experience with mass incarceration.
Sure.
And mandatory minimum sentencing. I was a 17-year-old guy, worked at Wells Fargo as a bank teller, and I didn't know anything about mass incarceration or mandatory minimum sentencing. I just like watched mobster movies once in a while. And yep. next thing I knew, I was indicted on a Measure 11 crime.
Mm-hmm.
And Measure 11 is one of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws that was passed. It was sold as an anti-violent crime law. Well, I was told by my attorney that, you know, even though he didn't think I was guilty, that if I went to trial, I would get a mandatory, you know, amount of months. And so I took a plea bargain.
Yep.
You know, but I know you know that happens a lot throughout the country. There's a new law called Measure 57, which is kind of similar. But my point is it's a real thing. A lot of people aren't aware of it, but I just actually recently got released from prison. And
congratulations, James. Welcome. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. The maximum wage in there is $75 a month.
So yeah.
Slavery evolving is definitely true. Anyways, and also another point I wanted to make was Jeff Sessions being the Attorney General is not good. I don't consider myself a liberal, but he's like totally turning his back on awareness of mass incarceration and addressing some of the, you know, things that Obama was like saying, admitting, hey, we need to make some progress on this issue.
He's rolling back the clock. It's like listening to him sounds like Nixon or Reagan, you know. It's so unoriginal, you know. I'm like, really? You're just like recycling the same script 30 years later. Well, thank you so much for your call. And the measure, I mean, I think it's really important for people to know that, you know, what this looks like specifically in Oregon. And mm-hmm. Measure 11 and Measure 57 are the two major laws that are, you know, increasing the amount of time that people serve. Measure 11 applies to people as young as 15. So it's, you know, it's one of the drivers of that juvenile incarceration rate. And the point that you make, James, is so important around the leverage that these mandatory minimums give to prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that because, you know, if you're guilty, if you were caught doing that, you know, or there's little chance of you demonstrating your innocence at trial, because there's a mandatory minimum sentence that's going to happen automatically no matter what the circumstances were, that gives prosecutors a ton of leverage to get you to plea to something that's still quite a long sentence for what it was. Yeah. So, I mean, I know I did most of my work in California. I met a guy in, you know, at a maximum security prison in California who was serving a 20-year sentence for possession of a small amount of methamphetamine, a personal amount, and an unregistered hunting rifle. And that was because,
wow.
Yeah, those, so because those two, because, you know, California has a three strikes law.
Yes.
He had another, you know, felony on his record from getting into a bar fight as an 18-year-old. And they prosecuted, you know, they were charging the possession and the unregistered hunting rifle as two separate felonies.
Mm-hmm.
So meaning third strike and you're out.
Yes.
Mandatory 25 year to life sentence. So he pled to 20 years.
Yeah,
And he was in his 18th year when I met him, and he was like, cool, I have like another year, no problem, I'll be out. Wait. But it's like, you know, he had a successful commercial fishing business, had a kid, you know, right. And this person was just locked up in a box for 20 years.
Not an unusual story at all.
No.
I'm James. You guys have a great day, okay?
Hey,
okay.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're
thanks,
welcome.
James. You're listening to More Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is Dr. Nicole Lindhall, who will teach a course in November on mass incarceration and the war on drugs at Portland Underground Graduate School. And to register, I guess you go to PUG's website and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's PUGSPDX.org.
Let's go to our next caller. I think we have another James. Good morning, James.
Good morning. You know, this whole thing, this is more of a personal story. It goes to the frustration of what mass incarceration does. You know, my mom, she did a really short prison term. It was probably about 6 months. It wasn't anything real, but that felony on her record, I don't know if you guys have talked about it. I'm a little late to the conversation, but, you know, it's like I watched my mom get doors slammed in her face one after the other, being perfectly qualified for a job and only having this one thing on her record.
Yep.
And, you know, she struggled for years, battled with depression. She relapsed on cocaine because she just was so depressed, she had no idea what to do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the big thing that most people don't realize is that, you know, felony could be anything. Felony could be anybody. And, you know, I always hate it when Fox News or other affiliates in our area do that, how many felons live in your zip code, you know, because it creates it creates fear, you know, because people think of felons, they think some big, burly, rough, unkempt person who just, you know, who's looking for a chance to strike again. But it's like, you know, for every one person caught or sentenced, that's the one thing that really bugs me is it's about sentencing, who gets sentenced. It's not about who's doing the crime, it's who's getting sentenced for the crime.
That's right.
So you have one person, and you figure, you know, at least for every one person sentenced for a felony, there's 10 other people who get away.
Yep.
At least, I don't know the exact figure, but, you know, the people who get prosecuted aren't necessarily the people who are doing the crime. That's why you see a lot of disproportionate black and brown folks. It's not because they're doing the crime, it's because they're getting charged with the crime.
And
ultimately, that takes away from our ability in black and brown communities to be able to build wealth.
And James, you also raised a point about the impact on families. And Nicole, want to respond to James?
Yeah, comments? James, thank you so much. You're bringing up like so many important points. First of all, just the challenges facing people when they have that felony on their record are just incredibly immense, you know, not just in employment, but also in housing. You know, like I have a friend who owns a home here in Portland and went to a landlord training class, and that's an all-day thing. She said the entire afternoon session was based on training people on how to do a criminal background check. You know, that's just the norm, right? When you fill out a housing application and often an employment application, is there's a box and you have to check it, right? And that box, checking that box generally means that your application is going straight to the trash. So
I'll be right back. So I'll be out with Candy in a minute.
You know, and you're to your point of like the way that you know, so when incarceration rates are concentrated in particular neighborhoods, particular communities, and so more and more people, more and more adults in those communities have this felony conviction, it absolutely holds down the wages and the ability of people in that community to thrive, right? Like it creates homelessness.
It contributes
to mental health issues. It's like it contributes to kids being in foster care, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, one of the best places that I've seen that really exemplifies is if you look at some place with a small population is like Hawaii. You know, you look at people who are being, you know, you've got natives who are being displaced all the time for petty crimes, and you know, the people are losing their houses because the people who are moving in are the ones who have the money and ultimately are who set the standard for making decisions. You know, you could look at any, you know, or some another place like Ferguson, Missouri, before the uprising, you know, the city was literally being, the wages of the city were literally being leveraged upon warrants in black and brown communities.
That's right. That's,
you know,
right.
That was the whole source of revenue, and they were showing how they were actually, they were calculating the revenue being pulled from missed warrants, court dates, all that. They were projecting that into the next year.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, it was something like 60 or 70% of the city's, you know, GDP was based on court fines and fees. Something
exactly
insane.
And yeah. Each of the cities were broken up into like six, like Ferguson was broken up into like six or seven different little sub areas, so they could literally be hit with a fine in six different places for the same thing.
Wow.
And
that's not,
you know, so it's
Missouri.
Yeah, I mean, the system is definitely stacked against those who are marginalized and can be scapegoated for a lot of problems.
Hey, thank you so much, James, for your thoughts. We want to go on to some other callers, but we certainly appreciate your comments this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
We are listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. With speaking with Dr. Nicole Lindhall, who will teach a course this November on the mass incarceration and the war on drugs. Give us a call, 503-231-8187. Let's go to Kathy.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
I thank you for addressing this topic, which is, I consider, one of the most important pressing problems in this country. And I wonder if you can address all the entities who enrich themselves, private companies and mm-hmm. law enforcement departments, through this mass incarceration and the war on drugs, which is really a war on our own people.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like the topic of the fifth class session. And, you know, what people call the prison industrial complex, and which kind of is referring to all of these entities that are benefiting from the status quo, right?
Right.
And a lot of times people focus, you know, they hear mass incarceration and they immediately jump to private prisons. Like there's some, I think maybe because of Orange is the New Black or something like mm-hmm. that, there's like this immediate association that like what's driving mass incarceration is private prison companies.
Well, especially with a lot of the popularity, so to speak, in the media in the 90s of private populations in the early 2000s. You heard a lot more of some of the abuses and then the fact
right.
that some states were currying favor for them so that they could get more revenue.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so like one of the kind of common misperceptions that I like to try to address is this idea. So private prison companies are a huge concern. Right, the fact that there are corporations that are making profit off of the incarceration of human beings is hugely concerning. However, you know, and to make it even more explicit, like the contracts that state governments sign with these private prison companies require that the beds in the private prisons be filled to 92% capacity. So, you know, it's absolutely abhorrent and it's a huge concern. But it's not, private prison companies are not what's driving mass incarceration. Private prison companies make their bread and butter actually in the immigration detention system. They account for about 60-something percent of immigration mm-hmm. detainees. They account for about 8% of the, you know, U.S. prison population. So we could ban private prisons, which we absolutely should, but it wouldn't actually make a significant dent in mass incarceration itself. And I know that's not what you were asking, but I just want to kind of make sure that that point gets made because I think it's important. Because the real concern is so much more complicated. You know, it's like so many different entities are making money and are sustaining themselves off of mm-hmm. the current system. And it's private and public entities. So, you know, it's not just private prison companies, it's also all of the companies that supply the goods and the and contract with the departments of correction to supply uh-huh. services inside. So that could be, you know, Cisco or whatever providing toilet paper and the, you know, food for the cafeterias and whatnot.
Telephone companies.
The telephone companies, which charge exorbitant, exploitative rates for collect calls, and then there are taxes and fees on top of the collect calls for that family members shoulder that burden. You know, I just interviewed my friend Melissa, who her brother is incarcerated in Texas. She's estimated the amount of money that she will spend on calls to her brother over a 5-year period of his incarceration, and it came to $8,000. So, you know, and then it's also people, you know, medical companies, it's nonprofits that do these behavioral management, you know, courses. Like there's, it's, and, you know, with the previous caller, we talked a bunch about the fines and fees coming out of the court processing and how there are cities that are relying on these fees in order to, you know, for a huge portion of their operating budget. Mm-hmm. You know, and then of course there's all of the people that are employed by the system, and you know, I don't love demonizing people who get a job. You know, I mean, one of the stories here is also that unionized labor really declined hugely starting in the 70s, and some of the only secure jobs that grew in population that had unions that provided a kind of stable income for men generally, but also women who did not have a college degree, are in corrections. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of people that get a job as prison guards are doing it for financial reasons. They're doing it, you know, they're
because that's the only job market in the area.
That's like a decent yeah. job. Yeah. You know, I mean, a decent in the sense of the wages. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the conditions are necessarily very decent, but you know, and corrections officers have high rates of suicide. They have high rates of hypertension. They have high rates of like early death right after retirement. You know, it's not an easy, the high rates of domestic violence. It's, yeah. It's not an easy situation to be in. So, sorry, your point.
We can go in a different vein and, you know, not incarcerate our population, but to give them jobs and training.
Absolutely.
So it's not as if, you know, people wouldn't have those same jobs, but we need to look at our people instead of being enemies, you know, as being our citizens.
That's right. Really think about like the fact that when somebody, you know, there's plenty of people that are inside for nonviolent, non-serious crimes. There's right. also plenty of people that are inside for violent crimes. And one of the kind of perspective shifts that I'm really interested in trying to help create is the idea that, you know, it's traumatic to experience violence, to be victimized by violence.
Right.
It's also traumatic to commit violence. And we need to look at the conditions that were going on in people's lives that led them to a moment of desperation and volatility in which they committed a really serious harm.
Right.
And
otherwise, we'll never change.
That's right.
Will there be resources so that we can become involved in the whole process of trying to change this culture? Are there?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. No, because this is an extremely important problem that I'm very interested in. So
cool.
Any help in getting involved would be appreciated.
Great. Well, I would love to see you come to the class, because that's really what it's all about, is helping people get more educated and get more, and then like link in to what's going on locally here, because that's where it starts, is locally.
Right.
Locally.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm Kathy. You are listening to More Talk Radio with Celeste and Cecil. This morning, our guest is Dr. Nicole Lindahl, who will teach a course on mass incarceration at PUGS. Go to PUGSPDX.org. www.kbo.org and register and find out more information. Let me remind you that coming up next on KBOO at 9 is the Old Mo Variety Hour, and they will burrow down to the great issues of our times and go where corporate media fears to tread.
I'll say fails to tread.
Fails
too.
To tread. At 10 is Locus Focus. Barbara Bernstein speaks with Eric DePlace from the Sightline Institute to discuss fire, floods, and the president, plus lessons that will enable a livable future. At 11 is What Are You Listening To? A show that asks guests about the music that is important to them and why. What's on your current playlist and how does it impact your daily life? Stay tuned to KBOO. Donate, go to kboo.fm. We thank you so much. Dr. Nicole, we have Ross on the phone right now.
Good morning, Ross.
Well, good morning. I just so much appreciate this program, putting a lot of detail and real depth into a topic that we know is important, but generally we speak in generalities. This is so good to see it handled in depth. The thing that I wanted to ask you to maybe comment on is what role is there in this phenomena of the demonization of the black male?
Oof.
So for example, if a black male comes into the courtroom and he's tall and big and strong,
mm-hmm.
Does he get more years than the smaller black man that comes in and mm-hmm. has it shuffles and puts his head down, and that's the one thing. Now, I want to make sure an anecdote
let her explain your first question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Certainly the demonization of the black male is a huge, huge underlying issue here, and you know, the hypersexualization of the black, you know, the kind of the fear of
the predatory black male.
Exactly. You know, and there's so many kind of rhetorical tropes that don't necessarily, in the era of mass incarceration, we moved from a time period when being explicitly racist was much more acceptable to a time when racism had to be veiled, right? In mm-hmm. order, you know, that people made racist claims, but without actually explicitly mentioning race or using derogatory language. So we get like this, the juvenile super predator was a big image in the early 90s. The crack baby.
The
welfare queen is the classic, mm-hmm. right? All of these are, you know, and one of the things we'll do in this class is we're going to read the introductory letter to the 1989 drug control strategy, which was the first kind of proclamation that came out of a newly created Office of Drug Control Strategy with the drug czar William Bennett, who, you know, I don't want to go into William Bennett right now, but yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, so they used the whole justification for this extreme ramp up in law enforcement budgets and sentencing policy and like this mobilization of like the militarized police that happened was based on the quote unquote inner city crack user, mm-hmm. right? So that's not a racial term. explicitly, but when anyone that lived through that era and we're still living in the aftermath of that era, we know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
That means a poor black person from an urban neighborhood. So absolutely. And I will also point out that you know, there's an amazing social psychologist at Stanford named Jennifer Eberhardt, who has done a ton of incredible work on exposing implicit bias. And one of her studies analyzed data from death penalty cases involving black male defendants. And they looked at photos of the defendants and analyzed their faces according to what they designated as stereotypically black characteristics. So wider noses, bigger lips, darker skin. And they found that defendants who had more stereotypically black features were more likely to receive the death penalty. I can't remember the percentage or whatever, but so there is some research, some high quality research that does support that point.
Well, there's anecdotal information as to how that shapes people's impressions, and that was internationally perpetrated on everyone by the changing of the magazine cover with OJ when his skin was darkened and the whole framing of the photograph was darkened depending upon who published the picture. And it was called out and it was demonstrated that that was one of the ways that people and I'm not commenting on his guilt one way or the other. I'm just saying that this is one of the devices that was used to affect people's judgment.
If I may, I'll share very quickly the anecdote. I once worked in with some friends, colleagues, in trying to increase the attention to men in reproductive health. And in the county, I had a colleague who worked with the staff nurses. And one meeting was with the nurses. They were talking about we need to have more attention to men. Our services are primarily reaching women. And if we could reach the partners, and one of the nurses comments, she says, we take care of men, we put them in jail. Now, these are very progressive people, and they say it lightly, but this is probably 10 years ago. But I just raise that because these stereotypes run deep amongst us all. And thank you so much for your comment.
Thank you for your call.
Bye.
You know, I have to question that whole idea of somebody being progressive and holding those thoughts. I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. I see it as being kind of a demonstration of the fact that you've got liberal bias as well as conservative bias, and both of those are what are driving this whole idea of mass incarceration.
Absolutely.
And we shouldn't fool ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, thinking of this as a right-wing issue or something that Republican politicians did, no, wrong. Mm-hmm. Many Democratic politicians were more tough on crime during the 80s and the 90s because that was the winning ticket to getting elected. And a Democrat had to almost outperform someone in the right wing in order to demonstrate that they weren't soft on this stuff.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting about the whole propagation of drug policies during the 80s and the 90s and the beginning, the next wave of spikes, because you mentioned that it was in the 70s, I think it's really important for us to recognize that it was during the 80s that you had Oliver North bringing drugs to the black community. So I want people to have that sink in, because I was thinking about when you were talking about the 70s, I thought, now that's when you had a wave of people in minority communities who were beginning to go to college because there were the grants that had been created to allow more minority and poor folks to go to college. So you got that spike in college attendance, and you have a spike in incarceration. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, was there any connection in that? And then in the 80s, you have the continued spike, but you know, and then the focus on drugs. And then you have the United States military bringing drugs to the black community. So if anybody is listening and they hear this, what you have is a squeezing effect upon the black community and minority communities, wherein you're being arrested for what somebody else is doing to get you incarcerated. And, you know, there's a phrase for that. I believe it's called entrapment. You know, and, and you have to stop and think about all of the other factors that are coming into play when you're thinking, yes, these people are inherently evil and, you know, use drugs. It's like, no, what other factors are at play in the community?
Yes. You know? Oh, and so there's so many. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a real, you know, cluster of you know, deindustrialization,
yes,
the loss of unionized labor, uh-huh, for people who didn't have college degrees.
The last push of unions being bigoted and racially separated, too, because
that's right,
the unions came to Jesus and recognized, oh, we need to be open to everybody.
Right,
yeah,
but at the moment, mm-hmm, that they started to be attacked,
yeah,
by this new kind of neoliberal regime that was coming in. And I mean, there was so many, there were so many different factors that contributed to this, including the kind of gutting of many of the social services that happened in the 80s with the Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then crack, yeah. And this, mm-hmm, whole, I mean, there's a whole huge rabbit hole that I think I'm going to kind of assign some supplemental reading or you know, like some suggested videos and stuff like that, mm-hmm, about this. We're probably not going to dive into it deeply in the course, but you know, for anyone that's interested in this question of the CIA's involvement in bringing crack into LA and you know, specifically connecting with Freeway Rick Ross, I would suggest searching the web for Gary Webb, the journalist from the San Jose Mercury,
yes,
who started to expose this and was later, you know, supposedly killed himself with 2 bullets to the brain. And also Freeway Rick Ross, who has been released from prison and has some pretty interesting interviews on YouTube. And there's actually a documentary out about his story right now. Yeah.
We have a couple of callers, but I also want you to end by sharing what are some movements or things
projects
that people are doing that gives you hope. But let's,
yes,
let's go to John real quickly.
Good morning.
Good morning. Great show, folks, brothers and sisters. Mm. And what we have to remember, too, is this is part of the reason why our democracy is not working at the federal level big, mm-hmm, time, and at the state level in many states. Oregon, we're lucky, you know, live on the left coast. And
lucky with the third highest incarceration of children. I'm not sure about that.
yeah, that's a good point. This is part of the divide and conquer strategy that the ruling classes have always used to divide us, especially USA since slavery.
Yep.
And we still won't face that fact. The institutionalization of racism and slavery continues. And also how it affects our ability to get our choices in this two-party system into office. Bush and Trump both, the statistics are there. They stole those elections. And we're reaping the wonderful evil benefits of it. And that's my point. And then felons oftentimes in a lot of states can't vote.
That's right.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's also partly because it divides us as humans based on color, which encourages more racial stereotypes, which encourages divide and conquer strategy.
Hey, thank you so much.
We've got to come together as working class people and lower middle class people to vote to get rid of these people.
Thank you, John. We run the, mm-hmm, short on time.
Yeah, and John, mm-hmm, your
you
point,
bye-bye,
speaks directly to this question of, like, what am I most excited about? So what I'm most excited about right now is a emerging movement, which is gaining steam, which is of people who have had direct experience with the criminal justice system. So there's, you know, just as one example, there's an amazing organization in Oakland called All of Us or None that has chapters in various different states that's for and by convicted people.
And now, are they working towards removing the barriers to voting and enfranchisement?
Yeah, they're working towards all of the above. They're working towards they were very active in the Ban the Box campaigns that have happened, which is like banning the box on employment applications until someone has at least had an interview.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully housing.
They're you know, organizing themselves to, you know, get on buses and go to the state capitals and talk to politicians and put a face to these stories. They were instrumental in writing a really powerful ballot measure that was passed in California last year that provided a kind of parole option for many people serving longer sentences inside the California system and required the system to create incentives for good behavior. So this movement that's happening that is coming directly from people who know what the system is actually like from the inside mm-hmm. is really, really exciting. And
will you have any connection with them in the classes for folks?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, yep. See, now that's a major incentive right there for folks if you are interested in making a change.
That's right.
Making a change. So once again, and we're sorry we're out of town for our callers, but once again, how can people find out about enrollment or future participation in your classes?
Yeah, so the class is called Mass Incarceration and the War on Drugs. You can go to the PUGS website, which is www.pugspdx.org, and look at the November courses, and you'll find it there. You can even email me. Mm-hmm. And my email is Nicole Lindahl, NicoleLindahl, @gmail.com. And I would love to see some people come into the class. It's going to be fun. It's going to be entertaining. And we're going to do some stuff.
And scholarships are available.
That's right.
Well, this has been More Talk Radio on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I want to thank everybody for calling and for listening, and more importantly, for being a member. And for everyone else, you too can become radioactive. Check us out at KBOO.fm and click on Become a Member, Donate, Support, all of that. Thank you, Cecil. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Nicole. And thank you, everyone else, for keeping us your community connection.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of